Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique context on the African continent.
Hello and welcome to the Big Change Podcast, where we are exploring how ordinary Christians can change their world. This is Jonathan Wilson and I'm your host. Today, we are joined by Dineo Dioma, founder and CEO of Docotela, a company working to increase access to healthcare in South Africa through innovative telehealth solutions where millions have extremely limited healthcare options. Welcome, Dineo.
Thank you so much, Jonathan, for having me. I'm really excited to be part of this conversation.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So let me give you a bit of Dineo's background, and then we're going to hear a bit of her story. So as I mentioned, Dineo is founder and CEO of Docotela. But in terms of her background before that, she was the co-founder and CEO of Cape Biotechnologies, which developed South Africa's first COVID-19 test kit. So that was the first local test kit developed, which improved the accessibility of test kits during the pandemic. Dineo sits on the board of the Alan and Jill Gray Philanthropy South Africa, whose work to strengthen the entrepreneurial ecosystem in Africa and also in higher education systems. Dineo was featured on the cover of Forbes Women Africa magazine in 2019, and she was listed as one of the 20 new wealth creators on the African continent. She was also selected for the Mail and Guardian's Young 200 South Africans business category, also in 2019. Dineo obtained her MPhil in Micro and Nanotechnology Enterprise with distinction from the University of Cambridge, where she focused on the commercialization of nanotechnology research and entrepreneurship. So, Dineo, welcome. It's great to have somebody like you on the podcast. You've had quite a journey. I think it'd be great for listeners to hear how you got to what you're doing today, where you are now trying to solve this problem of healthcare access.
Thank you so much, Jonathan, for having me. It's really quite exciting to be a part of this conversation. Just to share a bit more about myself. So I was born in the 90s, so which is just, you know, as apartheid was obviously transitioning out. And I was born in Durban, but grew up in Bloemfontein to two amazing parents. And I have two older siblings, so I'm the youngest. And we grew up in a Christian home, you know, filled with like hard work, discipline, a lot of love. And I'm really fortunate to have grown up in that setting because that really helped me to focus on being a disciplined individual whose goal was to contribute to society. And I remember, you know, growing up, I was really obsessed with becoming a doctor. You know, if you could ask me, I think around like 11 years old, I was obsessed with becoming a neurologist. It's all I could tell people. And I think the main influence was because of my late uncle, who was the first orthopedic surgeon in my family. Actually, the first doctor in my family. And there were a lot of firsts in, you know, during those times. And because of apartheid, people didn't usually, you know, get the opportunity to go study medicine. My uncle was the first doctor in the family. And I just remember how he just loved people. You know, he'd go to the rural areas and township areas and just serve people for free without expecting anything. And there was just something so noble about that. And I remember him being just so kind-hearted. And, you know, that was the first impression of like a role model. I was like, wow, I really want to be that kind of a person in community. So that's where my love for medicine actually started. And fortunately, as I mentioned, you know, we grew up in a very disciplined home where academic excellence was something that was always emphasized. I had awesome siblings as well who were doing really well at school. So there was no other way. I had to perform well. My parents also worked for the Department of Education. So there was no ways I could flunk. I had to be an A++ student. And I remember, you know, coming into grade 12, which is where in South Africa, you know, you have to choose what you want to study. Obviously, you know, I'd spent my life obsessing about becoming a doctor. But I remember when it was time for me to apply, I got the forms for med school and the only thing I could do was literally just write my name down. There was something inside of me that just couldn't proceed further with this application. I just knew that this is not it. And back then, I didn't realize that it's actually the Holy Spirit that was channeling me towards engineering and innovation, which was fortunately something I was really good at because I excelled in maths and science. Mm. And I just loved to create things. So coincidentally, also when I was growing up, I was the kid who would like, you know, tear the toaster apart and like put it back together. I'd get electrocuted a few times here and there. But, you know, I was really creative and loved to use my hands. And, you know, I think that's where the engineer side of me actually came together. So I ended up, you know, applying for engineering. And during that time, I also got introduced to the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation, which is an entrepreneurial scholarship, which focuses on empowering young students with entrepreneurial skills so that they can make an impact in South Africa. You know, there's a massive focus of how entrepreneurship can be used as a tool to solve for poverty, unemployment, and any disparities on the African continent as a whole. Mm. So fortunately, I got accepted to be a part of that scholarship. And here I was as an engineer, you know, I felt like I was studying 2 degrees because here, you know, we'd have Saturday school where, you know, they teach us about entrepreneurship, you know, identifying problems in the market, writing business plans and et cetera. And then Monday to Friday, I had my really demanding engineering degree. But that was really just a beautiful experience because now I have this love for medicine. I've got this innovative mind and I've got this exposure to entrepreneurship. And God just really guided me along the way as to how I can marry all of these 3 aspects together. And I think that's essentially how I got into the healthcare space. Because, you know, even though I was in engineering, there was just that deep love for people and medicine that I just couldn't knock off. And I remember I actually started experimenting with a few entrepreneurial ideas when I was in 4th year of my studies, 4th year going into my master's. And the first one was actually a company called Insightec, where we were developing a novel HIV test kit that leveraged nanotechnology. And that's where the nanotechnology part also falls in. So, you know, we were designing this device and I was like, yes, this is it. I want to use my engineering brain coupled with entrepreneurship and, you know, my love for medicine to basically impact the healthcare space.
Oh, that's great. Thank you for sharing that. Tell us maybe a little bit about what are the major dimensions of the challenges faced in the healthcare system in South Africa and how those are experienced by South Africans.
Gee, so the healthcare sector in South Africa is actually quite complex. And, you know, in present day South Africa, 2024, you can still see some of the legacy from apartheid to today. And the main issue is access and the disparities in terms of access and as well as quality. So you have a population where 84% of South Africans don't have access to private healthcare insurance, whereas the 16% does. So in South Africa, if you have a medical aid, you're actually part of the elite. It might not seem like it or feel like it, but you're actually part of the elite. And that's mainly because it's quite expensive for people to be able to afford. So if you look at a family of around, say, 3-4 household members, you could end up paying around 8,000 Rand for, you know, your monthly installment for medical insurance. And that is equivalent to someone's monthly home loan repayment.
Yeah.
So people are literally, you know, comparing those costs and saying, do I pay for a roof over my head or do I make sure that I have medical insurance? And, you know, you might take the bet and like, you know, my family doesn't always get sick, so I'd rather invest, you know, having a house over my head. So those are kind of the decisions that, you know, ordinary South Africans are faced to make. So it's definitely a lack of access. And then when you look at the public health sector, you know, it's extremely overburdened. I mean, supporting 84% of the population, and that's not even truly a reflection of what's going on. It's just, you know, statistically, they estimate it's about 84% of the population. It's extremely overburdened. And not only from an infrastructure perspective, but also in terms of the number of healthcare providers that can actually service this amount of people. So it really just makes it a lot more difficult to deliver quality healthcare to the ordinary South African. You know, you go to a lot of the major public hospitals and clinics, you know, you'll find a long line. You'll find grannies who are in their 60s, 70s, 80s sometimes, you know, standing in long queues for the whole day. You know, you even have to bring a little bit of like a lunch tin. People sometimes camp overnight just to be able to make it on time to be seen by a doctor. So perhaps they arrive at like 4 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, only to get help around like lunchtime, 12 o'clock or 2 o'clock. So I think we can just get a picture of like the sheer volume of the amount of people that actually rely on public health systems versus private. It's a huge problem that we have to address. And I think, you know, with conversations around the NHI now coming up, that need is being highlighted to say 30 years into democracy, surely we can't, you know, continue along the same path. We can't have the same stats that we had in apartheid being the same as they are in 2024. So that's essentially where also, you know, the conversation around the NHI is coming through.
Yeah, and just for listeners who are not in South Africa, the NHI is the National Health Initiative. And also the number that Danielle gave earlier, 8,000 rand a month for like basic medical coverage, is basically around $400. So that gives you, you know, if you don't know the rand, that gives you a sense of what we're talking about here. I'm just curious, how did the COVID pandemic either accentuate or even exacerbate some of these systemic factors around healthcare?
So I think COVID definitely highlighted those disparities that are taking place in the between the public and the private health sector. And also just mind you, Jonathan, I should have mentioned previously that in terms of health spend, the public sector and the private sector spend the exact same amount, but private sector services the 16%, whereas public services the 84%. So already, you know, that just further highlights the disparities between the two. But then going back to COVID, as I mentioned, it definitely did highlight those disparities. You had people who, if you were sent to ICU in a public hospital, it was a lot scarier versus in private healthcare where they're able to do more, where our medical aids are structured. You know, you've got your prescribed minimum benefits where if you're hospitalized, medical aid just basically has to pay, whether you're there for one day or 100 days. It's part of the prescribed minimum benefits. Whereas in public health sector, you know, resources are already limited. So they're not able to have as much advanced technologies that you would receive in the private sector. But even though I think as a whole, on a global level, I must commend South Africa. I think we did really well in our response to COVID, which, you know, also just highlighted in terms of our leadership and the way that we were able to self-organize. You know, I think globally, we're part of these conversations. Our country definitely does stand out as one of the countries that responded well to the pandemic. However, we still were aware of the fact that if you were in a public health facility, you were slightly disadvantaged in that regard. We also saw a lot of people dropping off of medical aid also because of affordability. You know, a lot of people either got retrenched or their salaries were cut down. And I remember we ran a COVID testing station at some point, and we actually saw this play out where people who come from wealthy suburbs, you know, would come to us, ask us for a refund and say, guys, can we just get our money back? We, for example, we tested negative and there's no need for this test, but we actually need that money to be able to buy food for our families for this week. And they would plead with us. And, you know, it was a really difficult time. And I think that's where my heart for services, medical services really came in, because we created this COVID test kit and I realized, like, you know, we could sell it at, hypothetically speaking, at like 1 rand or less than a dollar, you know, if you think in terms of dollars. But if the people offering the services are not willing to cut down their prices, the end user, the consumer, the patient is the one that still has to bear the brunt. We're just helping either the pathology labs or, you know, the hospitals make more money. But the person who really needs a cheaper service or more affordable service is the actual patient. And that's where my heart for services came in, to say, how do we leverage technology? What is it that we can do to make healthcare services more affordable? And that's essentially what it is that I'm doing right now.
That's fantastic. One thing, again, that I think will be important for listeners who are not South African to understand about the scenario you're describing is, especially I think listeners in North America or Europe probably have a view of South Africa as like a third world country. In other words, it's comprehensively at a low income developing country kind of level, but it's not.
Yeah.
It's this country of immense disparity.
True.
Where the healthcare, that if you're in that 16% that's obtaining private healthcare, it's world class. Mm-hmm. Related to that is the fact that there are leading scientists in this country, you know, epidemiologists because of the whole HIV/AIDS pandemic. So there are talented people in this country who have done exceptional work. And that's another factor. So it's not like we're trying to create healthcare access in a country where everything is just a shambles. It's that there's this incredible disparity.
Correct.
One of the things that will come out, I think, in the coming episode with my colleague David is we're going to talk about equality. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be talking about it in the context of venture capital. And we won't go into it now in detail, but I encourage listeners to look out for that episode when it comes, because I think equality is something called for in scripture. And as Christians, we're too quick to ignore it. So you've described the overall sectoral challenges in South Africa, but what part of those challenges have you decided to focus in on in your work at Docotela?
Sure. So Docotela is a telehealth platform, and we exist to make primary healthcare services as affordable and accessible as possible. And how we do that is that we leverage mobile technologies in order to do that. So a lot of South Africans fortunately have access to a smartphone. So we have a web-based platform where people can just book a doctor's consultation for 390 Rand. I'll leave that to you, Jonathan, to do the conversion. So what that comes with is it's a virtual consultation with a doctor. And then we also give a 100 Rand medication voucher with every single consultation if medication has been prescribed by the doctor. You know, sometimes people come in and they either want a referral to a specialist so they can just dial in and ask for that. And we are actually one of the first, if not the only, telehealth platform in South Africa for now that offers this add-on of the medication voucher. And what we really wanted to do is, again, make healthcare as accessible and affordable as possible. So if you go to an in-person doctor's consultation, that's around like 600 Rand, which is almost around $30. Yeah. So we're able to just leverage technology in order to cut down healthcare costs. We believe in focusing on primary healthcare and especially preventative primary healthcare. Mm. We want to make, you know, speaking to a doctor as easy as possible so that if you have a slight chest pain, you know, just call our doctors in and, you know, ask questions and let them give you a referral rather than wait for you to have a whole heart attack and then you only seek help. Mm. So we are quite passionate about preventative healthcare, identifying health issues at the early onset before they become complicated. And we also believe that, you know, if we give people ubiquitous access to healthcare, that helps with achieving that goal. So as it stands, we are virtually based, but we also have a vision to set up nurse-led clinics around the country. Mm. So we'll have clinics where, you know, we offer dental care, you know, primary health care, as well as optometry. And they'll be nurse-led. And when we need a doctor's intervention, then we'll have the virtual consultations. So we also work with a network of doctors. And if there's a need for a doctor to come in person, our plan is to just have them rotate every now and then coming into a clinic, maybe twice a week or so. So that's essentially where we're going. So right now we're focusing mainly on the telehealth, getting people accustomed to virtual consultations. You know, South Africans, we sometimes stick to it. Mm. So there has been a lot of education that has gone through to, you know, educate people around the fact that you can have a virtual doctor's consultation. Right. And people love the convenience. You know, you don't have to now, you know, stand at a clinic the whole day to be able to get access to a doctor. Yeah. It's super convenient, more affordable than, you know, going to a GP. We're really excited about that. And then as God permits, the vision is really to eventually own hospitals. But, you know, that's more like maybe a 10, 15 year journey. Yeah. We're just taking it one step at a time.
Yeah. And what I love when you use the language of convenience, like for somebody in the West, convenience means, like, if I want to go see a doctor, the convenience of an online platform means I've eliminated maybe a 20-minute drive to the doctor and a 20-minute wait.
Yes.
And a half-hour visit, and then I'm back home again. Whereas for the folk that you're describing in a typical township environment, that's a taxi ride. It's waiting on the street for the taxi. It's going to walk to the hospital or wherever, and it's sitting in a queue that could be a day.
Absolutely. Yeah. And especially those people who, if they miss work, they don't get their daily wage. Right. So this is great, because if you're not feeling well, you know, you just get your doctor's consultation. You don't have to take the day off. So it really, you know, impacts on people's livelihood and their ability to earn.
Yeah. So Dineo, your business is targeting people who are in the, what they would say, low LSM bracket, which is living standards measure. So the low LSM bracket. Tell us a little bit about on the economics of this business. So your price point, where does this sit in terms of the overall costs that somebody who's low LSM experiences in their lives? And then we'll also be interested as to how that makes money for you.
Great. This is so an awesome question. So when we think about LSMs, you know, it ranges from 1 to 10. There's actually a tool online that helps people to understand where they sit on in terms of the LSM bracket. So, for example, if you have, you know, a backyard, a swimming pool, you've got more than one phone in your household, you've got running water, you've got a toilet inside of the house, you know, you're more likely to sit on an LSM level of around like 8 to 10. And that's usually where people have access to private healthcare insurance. People usually from LSM 7 down, they're the ones that don't have access to that. People between LSM 1 and 2 are usually unemployed. And, you know, in South Africa, we also have government grants. So they earn an income. Their income is also based on that. With our solution, because we have been able to leverage technology in order to lower the costs, it actually helps us to reach people in an income bracket of from LSM 3 to 4 upwards.
Right.
But as I mentioned, you also find people who are in the higher LSMs who also use our services because, you know, they don't want to deplete their medical savings. They try to, you know, minimize overusing the medical aid so that their savings don't run out. And that's just a, you know, a challenge that everybody currently faces. And your next question around how do we make money? So we have a few revenue models. So we work with a B2C approach where, you know, you have the once-off doctor's consult. That's the one that's $390, which is $40, which is a once-off doctor's consultation with the medication voucher. And then we're also introducing a subscription-based model where you pay a certain fee to be able to access unlimited virtual doctor's consultations. And we're looking at a target price of around 200 Rand. We are working with some experts to be able to make sure that that pricing is correct and we're obviously able to still make money because what's the point of a business if it's not profitable? So that's one avenue. And then we also work with corporates using a B2B model where, you know, they use our services as an employee benefit. So in South Africa, corporates have been great in terms of helping their employees access private health insurance. So we work with corporates and offer them this package of the doctor's consultations. We're also introducing other offerings such as dietitians, people who are going to help with virtual exercise plans and et cetera. Yeah. So that's another offering that we have. And that's also subscription-based. And it's great because, you know, the corporates then pay us a retainer. They look at how many employees they have within their organization and we price based on that. So that's essentially how we're working at the moment.
Right. So the B2C, the business to customer or business to consumer revenue stream would probably be more volume based, I guess. And then
correct.
You've got these larger, perhaps, contracts on the corporate side.
Correct. Yeah. And those actually help with access to distribution. You know, you have one corporate who can give you access to 100 customers versus, you know, going 100 times to one customer sharing about your product. So it's been really great in terms of, you know, just getting the scale that we need.
Yeah, that's great. I'm curious, like, what are the typical health challenges on a more day-to-day basis that are being faced that people might be calling their doctor about? And I'm just unpacking this preventative side. Like, what are you ultimately working against in terms of long-term negative health outcomes?
So I know a lot of people, you know, when they think South Africa, they probably think, you know, HIV, AIDS, but fortunately we have really had great doctors and a great healthcare system just stabilize that. So that's a great one on our side. What we are seeing is an increase in lifestyle diseases. So that's hypertension and diabetes.
Yeah.
And that literally comes down to how people live, whether it's your diet, whether you're living a sedentary lifestyle or not. And that's why, you know, we offer this preventative healthcare approach, coupled with dietitians, coupled with fitness instructors to be able to help people just really change their lifestyle so that they can have longer lives. That's, you know, coincidentally also our slogan, a healthy life, a longer life. So we want people to focus on preventative healthcare. We also have an increase in cancer. And we also want people to be able to push for early detection. So, you know, we speak to women and we encourage them, for example, to take the cervical cancer test, HPV test. We also want to encourage men to, you know, look into prostate cancer and not be afraid to go and get their checkups. But what the things that we're really pushing for is the lifestyle diseases, where we think that if we can educate people a bit more about those, that can help to decrease the onset of these diseases.
Wow, that's fantastic. So what you've just described and what you're addressing is in itself really key. It's not a band-aid solution. This is quite fundamental. But nevertheless, it's still a component of a larger correction that needs to happen and a larger vision on your part. I want to hear more about that. But first, I want to take listeners on a bit of a journey into history to an example of something quite different, which was the movement to abolish the slave trade in the UK back in the 1700s. In the UK itself, it wasn't so common to own slaves like it was, say, in the US. But the slave trade was fundamental to the British economy itself. To move from that to a place where eventually the trade is abolished and where the British military is actually used to shut it down. So in other words, the British are spending money to shut down the, you know, this toxic system, and then also bring it to the point where the institution of slavery itself was abolished. Offer listeners a kind of a framework that I've used over the years with when I was doing management consulting, and we now use it in our company, Third Way Capital, when we're working with ventures who are planning out their growth strategies. And we bring a systems change kind of model to that. And one of the things that we talk about is very simple, is we use the analogy of climbing Everest, Mount Everest, or any, you know, large mountain like that. And most entrepreneurs, like yourself, the ambition that they have is, if you're to put it in realistic terms, they're actually trying to climb a mountain where at the top is the zone of death. You know, it's like when it's really hard to get there, and to get there is an extremely impressive feat. And it requires exceptional patience, tenacity, and hard work to get there. And if you're going to be a climbing team that is going to climb Mount Everest, what is actually crucial to doing so is to build a very strong setup at base camp. Base camp is not sexy. It's dozens of, if not hundreds of oxygen bottles. It's making sure all the right food is in place. It's making sure that all the gear is there. It's making sure that all the team has been properly trained prior to even arriving at the mountain. And we use that as a way of helping entrepreneurs to position what they're trying to achieve in a more realistic way that holds on to the ambition, but understands, if I'm going to climb Everest, I have to build base camp first. And every subsequent milestone in growing the business is going one more camp at a time. And of course, because you're dealing with systems change, you have to account for the components of a system. So if you're going to build base camp, let's stick with it for a second, you still have to say, maybe I'm biting off a chunk of the system that I'm trying to address, which is what you've done. And so building Basecamp, building your business that you're currently working on, Docatella, is just Basecamp, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when it came to the abolition of the slave trade, it was eventually abolished in 1807. But it actually took about 40 years to get there. And so if, you know, go back in time 40 years prior to that, mid-1700s, you've got primarily, I think it was Quakers and evangelical Christians gathering around a table, about five or six of them, including a gentleman called William Wilberforce, who's probably best known for his work in this, and sitting around a table and saying, we need to bring an end to this ungodly institution. And I'm quite sure that they would have loved it if they'd succeeded in about 10 years. And that's what's so impressive about the story, is how long they took. There's an excellent book called Bury My Chains by Adam Hochschild, and I encourage listeners to read it. He's not a Christian historian, but he doesn't hide the critical role that Christians played in this process. And what he brings out is how they began to get quite clever about the fact that, on the one hand, they're dealing with government policy.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
But government policy has interests behind it. The industry itself, like the sugarcane plantation industry in the Caribbean, and the guys in the supply chain, you know, the ship owners and the shipyard owners and the dock owners. And they did not take well at all to what was positioned as this moral campaign, you know, to end the slave trade. They're like, you're actually trampling all over my business, my well-being, my welfare. So there's government policy, there's the industry itself, then there's the market. There's the people actually buying in their minds, what they're doing has nothing to do with the slave trade. They're enjoying sugar in their afternoon tea. It's a very English thing. And still is.
Yeah.
So there's consumer lifestyle and the consumer behaviors. So, you know, regularly going to the shops and buying sugar. And then there's the actual beliefs and motivations that people have. And very often we try and target that first. Mm-hmm. But you're hitting a big wall when you do that, because those beliefs and motivations are rooted in my interests, my lifestyle,
absolutely,
and so on.
If you've been enjoying the conversation so far, please review this episode to help shape future content on Reframed.
So I want to unpack that a bit more, but I'm curious as to where you see some of that in your work.
That is a very complicated question to try and answer, but I'll really try to do my best. But Jonathan, I love the analogy that you've made between the slave trade and, you know, what happened during the slave trade and now this introduction of the NHI in South Africa. So just to also give some context, so the current conversation is around everybody contributing to this big fund of the NHI and there no longer being any private medical insurance providers in South Africa. Mm. And of course, you know, once you do that, you do touch on some people's personal interests and some people get excited. Some of them, you know, are not interested in having a system of such a nature. I think it was a week or two ago, I was in a very interesting debate, fiery, fiery debate, where, you know, we had different stakeholders, one from government, a very prominent doctor, describing why we have a need for the NHI, actually stating that, you know, this hasn't been a conversation that's been taking place since 1961, when apartheid was still quite prominent during those times. So he's got his own viewpoints and obviously, you know, looking at public health as a whole. We had people who are also very prominent lawyers who are part of drafting the NHI bill. And, you know, some of the points and the rebuttals that they had around why it will work and why it won't work and how it should work. Mm. We had, you know, people from medical insurers, you know, it's $1 billion industry in South Africa, not even billion rand, $1 billion industry in South Africa. And now to completely scrap that and say everybody must be under an NHI, you know, they also have their own business interests to try and preserve. And I think last we had an academic as well in looking at, you know, the economics of South Africa and whether this will be a viable solution or not. And then lastly, we had one of the prominent unions, worker unions come in and say, look, guys, we've seen how our workers are struggling. They don't have access to private healthcare. And a solution like this would work so well for the country. And, you know, you're sitting and you're looking at these different debates and how everybody has a viewpoint on it. And it's really difficult to please everybody. And I don't know if it is possible. And also, you know, I always try and understand what's God's heart behind these conversations and, you know, behind these bills that are being proposed, right? And what the NHI ultimately wants to address is equal access to healthcare for everyone, irrespective of your social status. And I think that's definitely something that is in alignment with Christ. Christ is not an elitist. He loves everybody, rich, poor, you know, whether you can afford or not. That's also one of the things I love about South Africa is that, you know, we are very big on emphasizing human rights and saying that healthcare is a fundamental human right. But the how we do it then becomes a bit complicated. So some people don't believe, you know, we should have this big pool of funds where people who are already feeling heavily taxed are going to be taxed even further. And we don't even know if the money is going to be used as efficiently as possible. This morning, coincidentally, I was reading the book of Ezra. I think it's in Ezra 1 verse 6, where it was describing when it was time to rebuild the temple. You know, you had neighbors coming in and pooling in resources. You know, they gave gold, they gave silver, they gave livestock and contributed all of this towards building the temple. So there's this idea of pooling resources in order to achieve one mission. But the key, and I think is the operative word, it was that they gave willingly, right? It was not under compulsion or feeling forced. People gave freely in order to rebuild the temple. And I think that's also one thing that is behind God's heart. God loves cheerful givers. And, you know, we shouldn't be forced to give under compulsion. And I think that's the sentiment that some people have around the NHI, that now we're being forced to give to this big fund that we don't even know if it's going to be managed well. And, you know, there's a lot of sentiment around the fact that due to corruption and greed, even the taxes that have already been collected haven't been used as they should. So now you want us to give even more. Yeah. Can we really trust that you'll be able to do that? You know, there's also debate to say, like, look, if you look at the UK, they have that mixture of, yes, the NHI, but, you know, people are still able to have their own private health insurance. Should that be the route that we go to rather than making it an exclusive NHI? So it's really difficult to come to a conclusion. And I think as a nation, these are the conversations that we're going to keep on having. And, you know, the transformation that we wish to see, that you mentioned, you know, with the slave trade, that it was a transformation that took years to achieve. It's not going to happen overnight, but it's good that we're having these conversations to say, guys, there's actually a problem. There's massive inequality that's taking place in our society. You know, the haves and the have-nots. What are we going to do to solve this problem? It's now the how we go about doing that. And I really just pray that God just guides legislation, guides, you know, people in government, the decision makers, and even guides innovators, because I think there is a space for individuals such as myself to contribute to that vision and mission. You know, we're looking at how telehealth can help to, you know, decrease the load of people who go and queue up at clinics. You know, if you need to get a prescription, just call the doctor instead of having to, you know, flood a hospital clinic with something that could be solved virtually. If once we set up clinics and, you know, hopefully hospitals as well, we are able to be service providers for governments and, you know, we make sure that we offer a high quality service. So it also goes back to that analogy of like, what is Basecamp for us and what is that Everest? So our Everest, or that peak of Everest, is when we see a system where, you know, we've got just well-run, state-of-the-art technology that everybody gets access to and healthcare facilities that everybody gets access to, and hopefully that people actually don't need. Right. To be quite honest with you, I know it makes sense for people to, you know, you always have a market for your business to run. But if we have healthy people in South Africa that don't need to be hooked up to ICU machines, having dialysis, that is actually the win. And I think that's the heart of God to say, we actually don't want sick people in society. What do we do to ensure that we get to that point where, you know, we have healthy people?
Yeah.
So I guess that the Everest is healthy people, but also having state-of-the-art facilities and technologies that can cater to everyone. If you're in a township, for example, Soweto or Alexandra, you know, where people are generally in the lower LSMs, they get the same quality of service as someone in Constantia, as someone in Sandton, as someone in, you know, one of the prime locations in South Africa. It doesn't matter. In fact, we'd love to see a situation where people in Sandton move along to Alex and Soweto to come and get help because the quality of service is so good. That's really the ultimate vision of what we want to achieve.
That's fantastic. I love hearing you unpack that. And as one humorous example, here in Cape Town, the Department of Home Affairs has to be one of the most hated institutions that anybody tries to access, whatever their LSM.
Yeah.
But the Home Affairs office in Khayelitsha, which is obviously one of the big townships out here, is the best place to go.
Great. Yeah,
you get way better service there than you do here locally in the suburbs. So
I love that. I'm hoping we achieve the same thing, that, you know, people use Sandton, they need Melrose Arch, and they, you know, they come in and use our clinic in Soweto and the likes.
Yeah. Well, one of the things about the abolition of the slave trade, that whole movement, I think there's a number of things that they did and that they experienced that I think are quite instructive. And it makes me think about, you know, the NHI and the move to equalize at a good quality level healthcare access in South Africa. And one of them was they became, at first they were just like anybody would be, just very linear in their thinking, just like we've got to ram through better policy, you know, that starts to work against the slave trade. And that just met huge resistance. But then they did things like they introduced clever policy mechanisms that appeared to be meeting desired objectives of the country, of the government at the time. For example, shutting down American merchants. Mm-hmm. But it was actually shutting down shipping routes that were for slave trade. Mm-hmm. So they would do these clever moves mm-hmm. that didn't on the surface appear to have much to do at all with the slave trade. So there was that. They were becoming wise and clever in how they were tackling government policy. They also did a lot of work to conscientize the population. So there's an educational component. And of course, that takes years. And campaigning around the country to help they actually got quite gross about it, where they basically, they use stories from the sugarcane plantations in the Caribbean to point out to the British public there may well be blood in their sugar, like actual blood, because of injuries and deaths that would happen on the plantations at the milling plants and so on. But the other thing that isn't, like Adam Hochschild gets to this point in his book where he puzzles over the fact that there was a revolution going on in France at the time that was about equality and liberty. Mm-hmm. The Americans had just released themselves from the yoke of the of British rule, but it was in Britain that this took place. Mm-hmm. Those other two places didn't achieve the full abolition of the slave trade or slavery. And he puzzles over this and he doesn't have an answer. Now, I have two observations about this. One is that what he doesn't really pick up on is that there was a massive evangelical revival taking place in the British Isles at that time. Mm-hmm. And it was the evangelical movement that was basically piggybacking on that revival and going to those people who were becoming Christians and giving their lives to Jesus, and who are now were realizing that, because many of them were poor, that there is a dignity that they possessed. Mm-hmm. So their own sense of self-dignity is improving, and they were being conscientized to acknowledge the dignity of the black man and the slave. And that was actually, the slogan was, is this man not my brother? Is the slave not my brother? Mm-hmm. I don't think that that conscientizing kind of movement would have happened if it hadn't been, or it would have been much harder if it hadn't been for that larger spiritual revival that was taking place. Many of the leaders of the abolition movement were from within that revival or were connected to it. So it's very, very interesting. But I think one final comment about that is, and this is from my own observation as I've studied social change, is that change that happens quickly usually comes about by some form of revolution, and revolutions are violent and destructive. So change might happen, but it often leaves a lot of damage in its wake. Change that comes by in a healthy way takes quite a while, as we've been talking about. Now I'll unpack that a bit further. But I think, you know, South Africa, it could have seen a revolution back in the 90s, but it became a peaceful transition that built on years and years and years of hard work. And I think for whether it's what we're talking about here in South Africa or some other cause, I think it's really helpful for us, really important for us to keep in mind, do we want a revolution that destroys a lot along the way?
Yeah.
Or are we ready to be patient and work through all the different components of a system to get it to a place where it is truly a place of reconciliation, where all things are in right relationship, including the people.
Absolutely.
You know, they're not alienated from each other because one group at last got its way. I want to talk about timeframes just quickly.
Yes.
We've alluded to this already. It took 40 years to achieve the abolition of the slave trade itself. Another thing that I think is really helpful for people to know is the economic impact was negative for the UK. You know, usually we try and play up the benefits of something.
Yeah.
But of course, today, nobody would regret the fact that the British GDP took a dip, you know, in order to stop this thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I think we also need to consider that if all of us have to take a hit in our overall income level or quality of life level so that the country as a whole has equal access to healthcare. I think as Christians, especially as Christians,
absolutely,
that should be something we're very prepared to take on.
No, I mean, I fully agree with that. I mean, if we have to get to that point, Jonathan, then, you know, maybe that is the right route to go to, because if you're not healthy, how can you productively also contribute to the economy? So maybe we take a dip or hit in the first few years, but as we get healthier people who are then able to work more productively and actually contribute to our GDP, maybe that's when we'll see the benefits of that in the long term. And maybe it won't necessarily be in the next year, but maybe in the next 5-10 years, we have more people taking their sick leave. We have more healthier people in the workforce who are just actively contributing to the country. And we have to have those conversations as well. You pointed out to a fact around, you know, wisdom. And we're just so blessed to be able to ask God for wisdom. You know, there's a Bible verse that says, if you ask for wisdom, God gives it in abundance, irrespective of who you are. So I think as a nation, we also need to just go before God to say, how do we face these policies and what are the right policies? You know, sometimes we like to sit in our own little corner and strategize, but, you know, we don't even come up with the optimal policies, but we've got the most creative, the most just God that we can go to in our time of need, approach his throne and ask him for that wisdom to really figure out what the right strategies and the right policies that we should put in place. And I really pray that, you know, a lot more Christians, whether in politics and business and healthcare, and even just the church as a whole, come together, because you know, sometimes we have this dualistic way of thinking to say church is on Sundays only, Monday to Saturday. God is outside of that. We'll see God on Sunday. And that's really a wrong set of thoughts to have. Mm. We need to think about whether it's in our families and in our workplace and politics. You know, I really wish even more Christians would be, you know, active engagers in politics and entrepreneurship, policy making, so that we can bring the heart of God to these rooms, to these tables, and not just corner God to a Sunday service or corner God even to just my family. You know, God literally wants to touch all spheres of our lives because his heart is towards people. And if people are in economics, God is going to be there. If people are in healthcare, he's also going to be there. If people are in forestry, you know, if people are in banking, God is going to be there. And so I think it's really important for us not to box him and to just go before him, ask for wisdom to say, Lord, what are the best policies that we need to put in place? How do we change people's mindsets? How do we let people start thinking about the nation as a whole and not just, you know, their comfort zone and what works for them? And I really believe that we can only get that wisdom from God.
Yeah, that's great. We often sing, you know, worship songs at church that celebrate God's greatness.
Yes.
And I think we need to then say, if we believe that, let's start acting like it. That means we can take on these Everests.
Absolutely. You know?
It doesn't mean the law, because God doesn't work like that. He doesn't pull the miracles of, I mean, he does all kinds of miracles along the way, but he doesn't pull the miracles of massive social change in a year. He draws us into these long journeys because he's healing a whole system.
That's right.
But we need to take on those journeys.
True.
So that brings us to talking about your journey again.
Yes.
Yeah, as an entrepreneur. And so I'd like to unpack some of what that's actually been, especially for listeners who are in business or maybe they're in some sort of social entrepreneur project or NGO. But the key sort of experiences you've had in building up a business, the challenges, the failures, the successes. So let's start with the actual operational side and just trying to build a strategy and execute on it. What have you experienced? What was difficult? What have you learned?
Great. So from an operational perspective, I'm really fortunate that, you know, I've spent the last 10 odd years really trying to better understand the consumer and the end user. So I'm an engineer. I always think about, you know, these innovative ideas, and sometimes they're a bit like left field. And, you know, it's really important that we understand what are people actually grappling with, so that when you create a solution, it's a solution that meets their needs and not, you know, what do you think would be nice and fancy. My experience, fortunately, has also helped me to build a network of individuals that I can reach out to. So, you know, we've got a network of doctors, we've got a network of healthcare experts as well, who look at maybe like more on the financial side to say, okay, this is a good product, you know, pricing wise, this is more or less where we can go. But it's really a network of individuals, and I wouldn't say it's just myself. And also having exposed myself, done a lot of trial and error. I have had some, you know, ventures which did not go the way I wanted them to, but those were always such good practice to get to the point where we are today.
So, Danae, I've seen a trend over the last couple of years towards what, like, especially in the financial services side, to fractional services, so fractional CFOs, fractional mm-hmm. accountants. In other words, their time is broken into fractions, and and these are, you know, subcontracted out usually to maybe two or three clients. Is there that kind of opportunity in, say, amongst nurses and doctors, where they would have more opportunity by being tied into a business like yours?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, in South Africa, we call it the gig economy, where you can basically be a locum. You work for one company, another, and, you know, you're able to do it as a side hustle, or maybe it's your main source of income, but you just literally rotate around the different organizations. So with our doctors, they are able to do that. So we've got doctors who work on several other platforms, to the point where they can literally just have that as their main source of income. They no longer have to have a practice. They can just do exclusive doctors, virtual doctors consultations, which is great because their quality of life has also improved. I was speaking to one of our doctors recently, and she was like, I can finally, you know, raise my son. I can work from home. I can pick him up from school, take him to swimming lessons. And then in between, I'm doing virtual doctor's consultations. Whereas when I had a physical practice, I wasn't able to do that. And, you know, sometimes doctors also just want to help people. Now they have to think about finances, accounting. They have to, you know, think about paying salaries, hiring admin teams, making sure that things are running well, all the admin related aspects of a business that, you know, they didn't really anticipate that they have to deal with. Now with virtual consultations, we essentially take care of that. We do the marketing, we do the admin, we do everything, and they literally are able to just focus on what they love to do, which is help people. So with our doctors, definitely we are able to do that. With other functions within the organization, I mean, we've worked with outsourced accounting firms and legal firms and et cetera. I think it's also quite nice. It works well, especially in the early stages where, you know, you're trying to cut costs as best as possible and you really want to be frugal. But with time, it's really great when you can in-house that function, because now you can sit with your accounting team or your legal team and discuss strategy and say, look, how are the finances looking? What in 10 years time, what do you think we can build towards? What are the main sources of revenue that, you know, are our biggest hit? And how do we create products that help to improve the sustainability of the business? Where are we getting the great payers and the not so great payers? You know, what do we do about that? And also from the legal side, you know, how is legislation changing so that we can align ourselves with, you know, where the law is going? Now, if you have like part-time people, it's very difficult. They're just there to fill in a specific function. Hey, you need your management accounts done. There you go. At the end of the month, and that's done and dusted. But, you know, from a strategy perspective, you don't get that richness that you would with a part-time team. So I'm definitely pro a full-time, you know, legal and CFO functionality. But I also understand, you know, as a startup, it's important that you build up towards that point. But in the early stages, try to be as frugal as possible.
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. I hope this is interesting to our listeners, because, you know, on the one side, on the delivery side, it could actually be quite effective to build up a wide network of doctors, nurses, et cetera, through sort of fractional or gig economy type service. In terms of the internal side of of your operation, the ideal is to build up your own team that maintains that, you know, that muscle memory of running the organization and what it takes and what you have to know and so on.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about the role of capital, raising it, deploying it. Like, how has that been as an experience for you?
So that's been a very interesting journey for me. And I think mine is slightly different than the typical entrepreneur in South Africa. And I'll share why. So I did mention that I was part of the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation, which was started by the late Dr. Alan Gray, who ran an investment firm, Alan Gray Limited. And he basically established the Alan Gray Orbis Foundation and E-Squared, which is a, you know, they're all related organizations. So Alan Gray Orbis Foundation focuses mainly on the education component, training us to be high impact entrepreneurs. And once we have, you know, a bankable business idea, not just, you know, it's not free money, you know, we can then approach this organization called E-Squared, where we can get funding for our businesses. So I think I've been slightly privileged in that sense. I'm really grateful for that opportunity. And, you know, to have had Dr. Alan Gray just even think of this vision, you know, even in the Bible, it talks about a good man leaves an inheritance for his children's children. Yeah. Now I feel like this is my inheritance. And I mean, there are like 1,000 of us, and we're just beneficiaries of his hard work, his heart for South Africa. Also, fortunately with E-Squared, because they focus on high impact, but highly ethical and responsible entrepreneurs. So when it comes to value alignment, it's always just been an easier conversation to have and say, look, guys, there's this idea I want to work on. Can you help me? You know, can you support me in order to build it? And this is what I want to achieve. You know, from an ethics and value alignment, it's been really great to have those kind of conversations with them, because, you know, there is that alignment that's there.
And what are the key ways that you have deployed the capital that has been brought to you and or might in the future?
Initially, it was around testing the idea, whether it be like market research, doing customer interviews and the likes. But where I've mainly used the capital is to build a prototype and start with marketing to acquire like the first customer base and grow from that. Yeah. And then our next conversation is now around scale. You know, once we've really got that 100% sweet spot product market fit, because also when you're prototyping, there's some things that you will refine until you get to that, you know, that sweet product market fit. And then once we have that point, then we're going into another conversation around scale and growth.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, I think this is really helpful for anybody listening who wants to be an entrepreneur, is an entrepreneur and wondering about the role of capital. Mm-hmm. And you've described what you use it for, and I think that's really helpful. And I want to return to the point that you're making, which I don't want listeners to lose, which is the alignment of values between you and the person or the company providing capital to you. And I mean, I'm in that space of capital deployment, and I think that value alignment is key. Now, because you're going to be journeying together for a while.
Absolutely.
And if it's debt, then you have to repay it. If it's equity, then the investor expects a return. And you don't want to be in that long-term sort of marriage-like relationship with someone. And it's difficult because you actually have underlying different moral or social considerations in terms of the outcomes of your business.
Absolutely.
As well as the business case itself. Now, you've had to face choices around values alignment. I think that would be helpful as well for folk to hear, like, you know, what challenges have you faced and how have you addressed those?
Yeah, absolutely. I think any business, you will get to a point where, you know, your values and your morals are tested. And sometimes it also comes down to the nature of the opportunities that you receive. I remember there's this one particular opportunity and we were going to get paid quite a substantial amount of money to be able to do it. But my heart just was not settled with it. It was a very difficult time for me because, you know, obviously as a founder and also as a CEO, you are sitting with employees and you're looking at this opportunity to say, like, if you say no to this,
right,
this could actually impact the well-being and my ability to, you know, pay people's salaries. And it was a really tough time for me to go through. And I remember, you know, really just battling with this matter in my mind because I'm obviously at a very tough line. So I reached out to my investor and, you know, we had that in conversation with them to say, like, guys, what do you think about this opportunity? Because for me, like, yeah, it just doesn't sit right with me. And I was so fortunate that, you know, they immediately told me to say, no, we are an organization that favors responsible entrepreneurship. This is not a responsible opportunity, forget about it, let it go. And I remember it was actually a joint opportunity with another business and we were going to do it together. Now, this other entrepreneur's investor, what they said to her was that, no, don't worry, just do the job, take the money, right? But just don't tell anybody about it. And I was like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
There's something in that person's heart that knows that this is wrong, for you to be able to say, do it, but don't tell anybody about it.
Yeah.
And that's when I knew, I was like, you know what, it's so important to have value alignment with your investors so that when you get yourself into these positions, it's not a debate. So it's really important for me as a Christ-led entrepreneur to be able to honor God in my decisions, even if it costs me something. And sometimes our decisions will cost us something.
Yeah, yeah. I appreciate you sharing that story, Danae. To go back to the base camp before you climb Everest, it's like being willing to take a shortcut to build base camp when you take on something like that. It feels like, yeah, well, I might get some cash flow here and be able to pay my employees. And if I don't, we're in a bit of a stretch. But at the same time, you could well be creating a base camp in which you're one rope short, you know, one oxygen tank short, and it's going to affect you further on, but you got a nice paycheck, you know, it's that kind of thing.
Yeah.
This has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you. What I'm hoping, amongst many things I think listeners will gain from this conversation that we've had and the things you've shared, is the spirit of it, that we care about what our brothers and sisters can't access, and that we take it upon ourselves to be a part of the solution. I think there's, I don't know how, you know, how widespread this thinking is, but I do run into it sometimes that the poor, post-apartheid especially, that the lower LSM,
yeah,
they've had time to get their act together and, you know, and make things happen. And that's just not fair or accurate to their circumstances. They are recipients of extremely broken systems. Yeah. They have very little agency. And I do think that as Christians, it's our responsibility not to, again, you know very well, it's not about giving handouts. Mm-hmm. It's about creating access and opportunity. And we both know that people with better health also have the ability to take greater initiative Correct. In their lives.
Yeah.
They can be entrepreneurs when they're healthy.
Absolutely.
They struggle to be entrepreneurs when they're not. And like you said, this country's future is going to depend in part, and actually significant part, on successful entrepreneurs building small, medium-sized businesses. So I think what you're trying to achieve here is fantastic. I think it's a great example of what's needed in this country and elsewhere. And I'm hoping that people are inspired. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great joy to be part of this conversation.
Yeah, likewise. That brings us to the end of this episode. If you have enjoyed this podcast or others that Ziwani posts, please rate and review us on your favorite podcast platform. That is important because it's those ratings that drive more listeners to the podcasts. And then be sure to come back in 2 weeks for the next episode, which I mentioned a bit earlier. And that is called Big Change Through Investing, Reinventing Venture Capital in Africa and Beyond. And we'll be joined by my colleague, David Harley, who is the CEO of the venture holding company, Third Way Capital, which he and I and another partner founded together. David and I will be discussing transformational ways of deploying capital into early stage ventures, especially in the context of the history of colonial exploitation that this continent experienced. So against that backdrop, how do we build into companies that are going to shape the future of this continent in a really good and positive and healthy way? So until then, this is goodbye from me, Jonathan Wilson.
Thank you for joining us. This episode of Reframed was brought to you by Ziwani, a community of business leaders who partner together to live out their kingdom calling in the marketplace within Africa. Ziwani is a Mergon initiative. To know more about us, visit our website at ziwani.com. That's ZIWANI.com.